Hello, and welcome to this edition of Emanations, formerly known as Wake Up Call. My name is Bernard White, this is Radio Justice, and here is our new theme song.
Cause there's something inside so strong. I know that I can make it. Though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone. Oh no. Something inside so strong. Oh, something inside so strong. My voice, the louder I will sing. You hide behind walls of Jericho. Our lies will come tumbling. Deny my place and time. You squander wealth that's mine. My light will shine. So brightly it will blind you. Cause there's something inside so strong, so strong. I know that I can make it. Though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone. Oh no. Something inside so strong. Oh, something inside so strong. Brothers and sisters, when they insist we're just not good enough, but we know better, just look them in the eyes and say, we're gonna do it anyway. Gonna do it anyway. Something inside so strong. And I know that I can make it. Though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. Oh, then my pride was gone. Oh no. Something inside so strong.
Inside so strong.
Well, here we are, brand new year, 2018. 2017 was no joke. It took the whole country, if not the world, to a place it's never been before. A case where the patients have taken over the asylum. As I said earlier in this program, well, here we are, brand new year, 2018. 2017 was no joke. It took the whole country, if not the world, to a place it's never been before, a case where the patients have taken over the asylum. As I said earlier, this program will now be known as Emanations. Wake Up Call was the name of a program that I co-hosted with Amy Goodman that started in the early 90s at radio station WBAI in New York City. It was a very successful program. It raised a lot of money as well as consciousness. We brought to the airwaves issues and individuals, all of whom had interesting and important stories to tell. During the Christmas holidays in 2001, was it 2001? Or 2000. Amy Goodman, as most of you know, went on to become co-host of Democracy Now!, and I became program director after the sudden death of Samori Marksman, who was an extremely creative and talented program director. Then on... Let's go back a bit. On December 22nd of 2000, Pacifica's management carried out a takeover of WBAI. Security guards were brought in, the locks were changed, and the next morning, termination letters were delivered to me, my director and producer of Wake Up Call, Sharon Harper. And we were both, and the reason why they did that is because we were both opposed to what we believed was the imminent takeover of WBAI. We were both threatened with arrest for trespassing if we tried to come back to the station. The Pacifica board appointed WBAI talkback host, Eutrice Lead, as interim station manager. Other WBAI staff were locked out of the building. Anyone who entered had to be on a list approved by the board. Among those locked out were Amy Goodman and national board member Leslie Kagan. A memo from management was read on the air announcing that me, Harper, and Van Esler, who was the station manager at that time, had been fired, and that anyone who allowed us to enter the building or aided us in doing so would be subject to severe disciplinary action. As a result of pressure from the listeners, the coup was reversed. We were all returned to our positions. The dilemma was over. At least, we thought it was. But it actually morphed into a new struggle with different players. Now treachery happens under the guise of a false democracy, a democracy which allows those with deep pockets to take over Pacifica, and they have run it into the ground. In 2008, there was another takeover, engineered by two multimillionaires at WBAI and a devotee of Scientology from California. And they have pretty much destroyed WBAI. Any day now, that signal might become dormant. One issue that Pacifica refused to deal with is the issue of white supremacy. Until they do, they are doomed to become less and less significant. Well, that's a little of my background. Let's see if you like what Emanations has to offer. Stay tuned.
Jagwaragada ayelujara ona ti la arin odo re koja eru obodo odo ti shan ekun omi shan titi o ja si arin ona odo lohun legbon ona lohun legbon ati rin akuri eni so fun wa boya odo legbon tabi ona ni o odo laye eru obodo ojo ti pe ti olodumare oba adeda to da oke to da ona to da odo sile aye odo laye omi le niyan e je ka se rere o eru obodo
Oh! Surreal News, I'm Aaron Maté. President Trump began the year with a tweet denouncing Pakistan and threatening U.S. aid. And now he's following up. Last week, the State Department announced a new reduction of U.S. assistance to Pakistan.
Today, we can confirm that we are suspending national security, or we are suspending security assistance only to Pakistan at this time. Until the Pakistani government takes decisive action against groups, including the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani Network, we consider them to be destabilizing the region and also targeting U.S. personnel. The United States will suspend that kind of security assistance to Pakistan.
Joining me is Junaid Ahmad, director of the Center for Global Dialogue and professor of Middle Eastern politics at the University of Lahore, Pakistan. Junaid, welcome. Explain to us the significance of this decision by President Trump.
Well, it was quite provocative, being the first tweet by President Trump of the new year. The reaction from Pakistan was both anger in terms of the hostility embedded in the message, as well as somewhat of a heightened self-importance that this was the first thing that President Trump was thinking about as the new year came. So I think that, the context for this is, of course, an old one. This is the bizarre relationship that has been the U.S.-Pakistan relationship since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. That is a constant pressure on Pakistan to rein in the supposed groups associated with the Taliban and other militant groups like the Haqqani Network that have pretty much emerged in Afghanistan a few years after the U.S. invasion as a formidable resistance to that occupation and to the puppet regime in Kabul. But this has been kind of the recurring theme in the statements by both Washington as well as Kabul, that all of the difficulties the occupation faces, the regime in Kabul faces, there's one scapegoat for all of them, and that is Pakistan. Rather than face the fact that there is a genuine indigenous large-scale resistance in the country against the corruption, the incompetence, the arrogance of the occupation, it's much easier and convenient for all of these powers to just say that, well, Pakistan is responsible for all of the problems.
Right. So explain what Trump is missing here, because when he points out that the elements in Pakistan have given safe haven to elements in Afghanistan who the U.S. is fighting, there is some truth to that, right? But what is he missing there?
Absolutely. It's important to remind the listeners that the Pakistani establishment has had an old relationship in its previous incarnation, what was known as the Taliban, that emerged in the 1990s and took power in Kabul in 1996. That Taliban is different from what is termed the Taliban today. That Taliban was exclusively reliant on the support that it received from Pakistan in obtaining power in Kabul at that time. The current, what we call the Taliban, is a misleading term, because what it really is an umbrella group primarily based in the ethnic Pashtun parts of the country, which is, of course, the ethnic Pashtun population is 60%. Of the population of Afghanistan. And of course, it has a sizable portion of its ethnic tribes in Pakistan itself. So what we are looking at today is a resistance based primarily from within the ethnic Pashtun population, but not exclusively so, that is resisting. And what some of the groups that are allied to this resistance, such as the Haqqani Network, get in terms of, if you want to call it support from Pakistan, is shelter. That is, they are able to cross the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan without the Pakistani's able to do much to restrict that movement. But in terms of the type of support they had received in the past, there's nothing close to that. I mean, one just needs to look at the type of, you know, the attacks that they thrust upon the Kabul government, or say the Indian embassy, or the U.S. NATO forces. The weapons they're using, the IEDs and this type of stuff, I mean, it's fairly unsophisticated stuff. If they were really receiving support the way that they did in the past, actually, they would be doing far more damage to the occupation forces. This is standard classic guerrilla resistance taking place in Afghanistan. So I think there's truth to the extent that they may receive shelter in Pakistan, but in terms of active support from the military establishment, no, I don't think so.
So what does Trump's comments and this cutting of aid mean for U.S.-Pakistani relations and, you know, growing Pakistani relations with countries like China, where there's a deepening relationship? I mean, Trump was not the only official to make his feelings known on Twitter. The Pakistani foreign minister, Khawaja Asif, he wrote some scathing words about Trump, which I'll quote. "Our country witnessed the worst bloodbath. You carried out 57,800 attacks on Afghanistan from our bases. Your forces were supplied arms and explosives through our soil. Thousands of our civilians and soldiers became victims of the war initiated by you. We considered your enemy as our own. We filled Guantanamo Bay. For the past 4 years, we've been clearing the debris. We are feeling sorry as you are not happy, but we will not compromise on our prestige anymore."
Yeah. No, I think that about sums it up. I think that the way to look at what's essentially transpired since the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan is dictation to Pakistan, as the general, President Musharraf said at the time, actually wrote about in his book, that basically, the choice that was offered to Pakistan is either comply and cooperate or be bombed to the Stone Age, as he was told by a senior functionary in Washington. And so Pakistan essentially went along, but the expectation that Pakistan would engage in full-scale military assaults, which, of course, it was pressured to at certain times with horrendous consequences internally within Pakistan. That is to say, not only a large number of civilians killed, but millions, up to millions displaced from those areas bordering Afghanistan and areas in the country where the military had never gone into what's known as the federally administered tribal areas. And so the foreign minister is absolutely right that the human toll that this war on terror that's been imposed on Pakistan has been massive. And this is the crucial, you know, question that Pakistanis have been bewildered by: how the United States has expected to stabilize a country of about 30, 35 million Afghanistan by essentially destabilizing or conducting policies that were destabilizing a country of nearly 200 million nuclear armed, that is to say Pakistan, by expanding the war essentially into Pakistan. So it's been reckless from the eyes of Islamabad from the very beginning, but it's kind of had to go along simply because of the pressure. What has changed today, as you correctly point out, Aaron, is that there's been a strengthening of the relationship, a deepening of the ties between China and Pakistan. And of course, much of this has been in response to the way the U.S. has strengthened its own ties with India and downgraded its relationship with Pakistan. So what Pakistan has done in turn has increased a relationship that it's had for a very, very long time with China. And that relationship is very strong right now. It's taking the shape of both geostrategic and military as well as economic cooperation in the form of what's known as CPEC, the Chinese-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is part of the larger Chinese initiative known as the, you know, Belt and Road Initiative of Eurasian integration, of interconnectivity. So these developments are taking place. There's the rise of China in the region. There's, of course, growing Russian independence. And one of the other things that's important to know when we ask the question, you know, why after 16 years of this basically failed occupation of Afghanistan, now the longest running external U.S. war in U.S. history. Why would the Trump administration, you know, persist in maintaining its presence there? One of the things we have to realize is that right after the U.S. war in Afghanistan and after 9/11, the U.S. immediately went into many of these Central Asian countries to establish a military presence, which it did. That presence is now gone. All of these countries have essentially kicked the U.S. bases out. So Afghanistan actually remains quite critical, not for this Afghanistan per se, but because of the region. You know, there's Iran neighboring it, there's Russia, there's China, there's Pakistan. So all of these countries in a region where the U.S. has had is confronting declining influence, maintaining a presence in Afghanistan is crucial to remain a strategic check on all of these powers that it deems as hostile to its interests in the region.
Right, Junaid. So keeping with this point about China, President Trump's outburst about Pakistan coincided with Pence going to Afghanistan and saying that the U.S. is going to stay in this fight, even though 16 years of that fight has been a disaster, as you point out. So I'm wondering, especially now with China playing a growing role in trying to broker something inside Afghanistan, whether Trump's outburst against Pakistan can be seen not as an attempt to lash out at Pakistan for fueling the Afghan war, but for actually trying to work with China on maybe de-escalating the Afghan war and sidelining the U.S. role.
No, absolutely, Aaron. This is you know, what I call what the biggest fear, and it's causing this kind of paranoid anxieties within the imperial establishment, is kind of a Syria redux, where, you know, what you had at the end of this bloody war that had ravaged the country, Syria, at the end, what you had was the Turks, Turkey, which had basically facilitated U.S. NATO operations, the Gulf, and support for all these opposition forces in Syria. At the end of the day, sitting down at the table, not with any of these countries, especially the United States, but with the Russians and the Iranians, and forging some type of a deal for hopefully some post-war stability in that country, in Syria. The biggest fear remains the same in Afghanistan. The only sensible solution right now is, in fact, for regional powers to come to the table and broker some type of diplomatic and political resolution. And the Chinese were doing that, you know, the unthinkable over the past few months, which is bringing two countries, Afghanistan and Pakistan, that have had incredible level of friction and tension. But the Chinese were doing it. They were bringing them to the table, trying to broker some resolution, which is the only sensible thing. And I think this is what is frightening Washington so much, that in fact some type of diplomatic and political resolution will take place that will completely sideline Washington from the entire process. So I think that this is the biggest fear, a Syria redux taking place in Afghanistan.
God forbid we do the sensible thing. Junaid Ahmad, director of the Center for Global Dialogue, professor of Middle Eastern politics at the University of Lahore. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining us on The Real News.
Thousands have marched through the streets of Tel Aviv in Israel, demanding the resignation of the country's prime minister over mounting corruption allegations. The protesters were carrying placards and shouting slogans denouncing the government. RT's Murad Gazdiev picks up this story.
For 6 weeks now, Israelis have been demonstrating against the prime minister, the crime minister, as they've affectionately nicknamed him, not just in Tel Aviv, the capital, but now growing all over Israel.
Corruption has always been here for the last 2 years. Everybody's talking about him. It's coming up all the time to the media.
There is a feeling that the government is corrupt and puts its interests before those of citizens.
Netanyahu's government is corrupted 10 out of 10.
They're tired of it. I don't think he's going to get elected again. It's enough.
There are two publicly known cases against Netanyahu. In the first, his wife and he are alleged to have accepted illicit gifts, tobacco and alcohol, from a Hollywood billionaire. Luxurious champagne for the lady and fine cigars for the gentleman. Case number two. Netanyahu reportedly struck a deal with a major newspaper where, in return for more favorable coverage, he would weaken a rival newspaper, using his office and powers as prime minister. Serious allegations. Stuff like this has put people in jail. You think Bibi's scared?
If there will be recommendations by police to indict, so what? Here's a fact I doubt the public knows. The vast majority of police recommendations end with nothing. More than 60% of police recommendations are thrown out.
He, of course, denies everything, just like his predecessor, Ehud Olmert. Also denied ever taking bribes, even as he was handcuffed and convoyed off to jail. Bibi doesn't care. Police can recommend whatever they want. It's only if the state prosecutors decide to act will he face trouble. And he seems sure they won't.
They knew a year ago, even before the investigation. Why did it take a year? A waste of time and public funds.
There's more, of course. Questions about Netanyahu's connections, how Bibi's cousin ended up in the middle of a controversial billion-dollar deal to buy German submarines. You know how these things happen. But isn't it amazing?
Steve Bannon was curiously silent about the quotes that were attributed to him in Fire and Fury in the days after they were initially released, even before the book came out. And 5 days later, though, he did speak out. And he did so, I believe, because he was being eviscerated by the president and his surrogates. And so when he spoke out, he wanted Trump to know that he was really, really, really ridiculously sorry for the things attributed to him. Especially after this tweet from the president saying, Michael Wolff is a total loser who made up stories in order to sell this really boring and untruthful book. Again, he's saying it's boring because he's read it. He used Sloppy Steve Bannon, who cried when he got fired and begged for his job. Now Sloppy Steve has been dumped like a dog by almost everyone. Too bad. He says too bad, but he's the one who fired him.
Yeah.
Is it too bad? And also, why the dog hate? He always says like a dog.
Right.
Yeah.
He doesn't like dogs.
Is he dumping dogs?
I don't know. But anyway, Bannon did put out a statement, and here are some sections of it. I regret that my delay in responding to the inaccurate reporting regarding Don Jr. has diverted attention from the president's historical accomplishments in the first year of his presidency. So he said there, it's inaccurate reporting regarding Don Jr. So hold that in your mind as you read this. Donald Trump Jr. is both a patriot and a good man. He has been relentless in his advocacy for his father and the agenda that has helped turn our country around. So that's fine. Remember, inaccurate reporting. He goes on to say this, my comments were aimed at Paul Manafort, a seasoned campaign professional with experience and knowledge of how the Russians operate. He should have known they are duplicitous, cunning, and not our friends. To reiterate, those comments were not aimed at Don Jr. So were they comments that were aimed at someone else, or were they inaccurately reported? Because it sounds like he said that about the meeting, which, if you've read the book, you know, was Don Jr.'s idea. So it's difficult to take a group of the highest up officials in the Trump campaign who go to this meeting and say one of them is treasonous and bad, but the guy who set it up, not treasonous, because he's apparently, in the words of, in the implied words of Steve Bannon, so naive or so stupid, so to not know that Russian agents might attempt to pull one over on him. Is that what we're supposed to take from this?
Yeah, I have so many thoughts. First of all, I don't believe anything that Bannon is saying, especially now, considering his entire career is on the line. There's a significant likelihood that he won't even be employed by Breitbart anymore because Rebecca Mercer is pulling funding. Well, not pulling funding from Breitbart, but made it very clear that she is not supportive of Steve Bannon. But I want to just very quickly go back to Trump's tweet and. Again, his tweet, in my opinion, just reinforces the main thesis of that book, right? Like, he tells himself all these little lies to feel good about himself. The fact that he thinks the book is boring. If the book is boring, then it wouldn't have dominated the news cycle for what, how many days now? It's all anyone's really talking about. And so, no, it's not a boring book. I know that makes you feel better about yourself, but that's not the case. And secondly, look, Bannon is so pathetic. It's mm-hmm. I didn't expect this, to be honest, because mm-hmm. he presents himself as this like strong-willed, you know, stubborn guy who won't kowtow to anyone. And to see him tuck tail and kiss up to Trump's son like this, calling him a real American patriot, it's funny and it's pathetic and it's embarrassing for Bannon. Mm-hmm. And I'm enjoying every minute of it.
Right. It reminds me of Goodfellas. It reminds me of the Mafia. And their names are Don. Mm-hmm. So it's like on top of that, it's even better. But, you know, yeah. you have the guy who crossed the you know, the Don, the Godfather. And now he comes back. Hey, sorry. I didn't mean to say what I was saying. No. Great man. This guy's a great man. You know, it's the same feeling I get with Bannon going back to Trump. Of course, not crying any tears, although there are some bad parts of this in terms of American policy that I think could be affected by Bannon being out of the White House too.
Also the idea that he was crying for his job, I don't believe that he was crying for his job. His eyes are puffy, dude. He's not actually crying. That's how he looks. But also, it does seem a little bit odd. I understand Steve Bannon was very highly placed in all that. He was an advisor to the president, but he's being taken down for the things that he allegedly said, but that book is full of every person around Donald Trump,
right,
calling him an idiot and a moron, and not just that, but you know, attacking each other, attacking his son-in-law, attacking his daughter, all of that. It's odd that Bannon apparently is the only one who has a political price to pay for it, mm-hmm. which implies to me that it's not primarily about the book, that this is just the latest reminder of the feud between Trump and Bannon.
Well, remember, and I want to quickly mention this because it was evident in Stephen Miller's interview with Jake Tapper, there was a lot of emphasis about, oh, Trump accomplished all these things without Bannon. Bannon, you know, he wanted to take all the credit. Remember, Trump is a very egotistical person, and early on in his presidency, Bannon would get a lot of credit for being the mastermind behind Trump's policies.
Calling him his brain.
Exactly. And look, Trump did not like that. He does not like someone else taking the credit.
Yeah.
And remember, Bannon was the one that was accused of constantly leaking to the press, which he very well might have done. But we know that this White House has had an issue with leakers in general, including right now with Bannon gone.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And I mean, look, from early on, there were a lot of leaks coming out. If you believe what's in the book, it was all of them. And primarily, the information about the meeting in Trump Tower, it looks like Bannon probably was one of the ones doing a lot of the leaking there. And so you might wonder, why is this important? Is this just, I mean, he's not even at the White House anymore. Does this really matter? Is this just fallout from the book? But I think that it does matter, because while I would love for Steve Bannon to be someone that you never needed to know the name of, at least in the last couple of years, he has come to represent a very loud, very dark section of America. His position, not just with the president, but with that section of America, is very important for our politics going forward. And if the big backers of his site go with Trump instead of him, if the alt-right decides that they prefer Trump to Bannon, who used to be one of their intellectual leaders, that is extremely significant. So this is not for nothing that this is going on, whether Trump accepts him back into the fold again. So Willie, it doesn't look like it. From insiders, it did nothing, this apology, to quell Trump's rage at his former chief strategist or the anger of Bannon's former West Wing colleagues, who said the vibe in the president's circle was that people were unmoved by the statement. By the way, that was just a small section. It got really obsequious. Asked whether there's anything Bannon can do at this point to get back in the president's good graces, one White House official said curtly, unlikely. Which certainly doesn't mean impossible. Trump is a person who his view of you is entirely dependent on like his last interaction with you. If you say something nice about him, generally he will like you. And the inverse is true as well. It might not have worked right now, but you know, this isn't the last interaction they'll have. And so perhaps at some point they could make amends.
Washing the floors to send you to college. Staying at home so you can feel safe. What do you think is the soul of the knowledge? What do you think that makes her feel safe? Biting her lips and lowering her eyes to make sure there's food on the table. What do you think would be her surprise if the world was as willing as she's able? Hugging herself in an old kitchen chair, she listens.
comes to your hood and your race. What do you think she knows of despair? What is the aching of age? The father, the children, the brothers turn to her.
Thank you, Reese. In 1964, I was a little girl sitting on the linoleum floor of my mother's house in Milwaukee, watching Anne Bancroft present the Oscar for Best Actor at the 36th Academy Awards. She opened the envelope and said five words that literally made history. The winner is Sidney Poitier. Up to the stage came the most elegant man I had ever seen. I remember his tie was white, and of course his skin was black, and I'd never seen a black man being celebrated like that. And I have tried many, many, many times to explain what a moment like that means to a little girl, a kid watching from the cheap seats, as my mom came through the door, bone tired from cleaning other people's houses. But all I can do is quote and say that the explanation in Sidney's performance in Lilies of the Field, amen, 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 amen. In 1982, Sidney received the Cecil B. DeMille Award right here at the Golden Globes, and it is not lost on me that at this moment, there are some little girls watching as I become the first black woman to be given the same award. It is an honor. It is an honor, and it is a privilege to share the evening with all of them, and also with the incredible men and women who've inspired me, who've challenged me, who've sustained me and made my journey to this stage possible. Dennis Swanson, who took a chance on me for AM Chicago. Quincy Jones, who saw me on that show and said to Steven Spielberg, yes, she is Sophia in The Color Purple. Gail, who's been the definition of what a friend is. And Stedman, who's been my rock, just a few to name. I'd like to thank the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, because we all know that the press is under siege these days. But we also know that it is the insatiable dedication to uncovering the absolute truth that keeps us from turning a blind eye to corruption and to injustice. To tyrants and victims and secrets and lies. I want to say that I value the press more than ever before as we try to navigate these complicated times, which brings me to this. What I know for sure is that speaking your truth is the most powerful tool we all have. And I'm especially proud and inspired by all the women who have felt strong enough and empowered enough to speak up and share their personal stories. Each of us in this room are celebrated because of the stories that we tell. And this year, we became the story. But it's not just a story affecting the entertainment industry. It's one that transcends any culture, geography, race, religion, politics, or workplace. So I want tonight to express gratitude to all the women who have endured years of abuse and assault because they, like my mother, had children to feed and bills to pay and dreams to pursue. They're the women whose names we'll never know. They are domestic workers and farm workers. They are working in factories, and they work in restaurants, and they're in academia and engineering and medicine and science. They're part of the world of tech and politics and business. There are athletes in the Olympics, and there are soldiers in the military. And there's someone else, Recy Taylor. A name I know, and I think you should know too. In 1944, Recy Taylor was a young wife and a mother. She was just walking home from a church service. She'd attended in Abbeville, Alabama, when she was abducted by six armed white men, raped and left blindfolded by the side of the road, coming home from church. They threatened to kill her if she ever told anyone. But her story was reported to the NAACP, where a young worker by the name of Rosa Parks became the lead investigator on her case. And together, they sought justice. But justice wasn't an option in the era of Jim Crow. The men who tried to destroy her were never persecuted. Recy Taylor died 10 days ago. Just shy of her 98th birthday. She lived, as we all have lived, too many years in a culture broken by brutally powerful men. For too long, women have not been heard or believed if they dared to speak their truth to the power of those men. But their time is up. The time is up. The time is up. And I just hope that Recy Taylor died knowing that her truth, like the truth of so many other women who were tormented in those years, and even now, tormented, goes marching on. It was somewhere in Rosa Parks' heart almost 11 years later when she made the decision to stay seated on that bus in Montgomery. And it's here with every woman who chooses to say, me too. And every man who chooses to listen. In my career, what I've always tried my best to do, whether on television or through film, is to say something about how men and women really behave, to say how we experience shame, how we love and how we rage, how we fail, how we retreat, persevere, and how we overcome. I've interviewed and portrayed people who've withstood some of the ugliest things life can throw at you. But the one quality all of them seem to share is an ability to maintain hope for a brighter morning, even during our darkest nights. So I want all the girls watching here and now to know that a new day is on the horizon. And when that new day finally dawns, it will be because of a lot of magnificent women, many of whom are right here in this room tonight, and some pretty phenomenal men fighting hard to make sure that they become the leaders who take us to the time when nobody ever has to say me too again. Thank you.
Everything must change. Nothing stays the same. Everyone must change. Nothing stays the same.
But never much too soon.
From the clouds and the hummingbirds do fly. The rain comes from the clouds and sun lights up the sky and hummingbirds do
guest tonight is the beloved astrophysicist, author, and director of the Hayden Planetarium at the American Museum of Natural History. Please welcome my friend, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
I love the stars.
Just for you, my friend. Just for you.
Love what you've done with the place.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, you know, on the old gig over on the other network, you were the guest I had more than any other guest.
Really?
Yeah, you were there. You know that
you were
my guest.
Could it be that I lived nearby, so I was a cheap date?
Could it be we moved the studio someplace close to you so we could be near you, Neil? I just found out that you're also you're holding a vast lead on anybody else on this show. You've been on 9 times.
Yeah.
Nine times. Number two. Do you know who number two is?
No.
John Oliver.
Is that
six.
Right?
Six.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, so thank you very much.
But
good
the universe is vaster than anything else in the universe.
What? What does that mean? Don't pre-blow my mind.
Sorry.
Don't pre-blow my mind before I'm ready for it. We got a lot of interview here.
There's a lot in the universe to talk about.
Okay,
relative
sure
to anything else in the universe.
First of all, Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
Now, does the New Year have any particular astronomical significance?
No.
No, why not?
No, not.
We've gone around the sun, right? We've gone around the sun once.
Yeah,
that's
but
something.
The place where that we return to, there's nothing special or interesting about it. It's a completely arbitrary spot on the calendar that we have chosen to celebrate the new year. Plus, I think it's a little weird that we all celebrate that instant that the ball drops, and then 1 hour later, they celebrate exactly the same thing. And then an hour later, they do that 24 times around the world.
I know how clocks work, Neil.
The world is not celebrating the same moment. It's kind of, it's odd to me as an astrophysicist. But that's fine. It's culture. That's how we do it.
Could you be more Neil deGrasse Tyson right now? What do you... Okay, so you,
no, if we all
you,
have
live,
this...
you live to suck the joy out of other people's traditions.
No,
do you love? What is worth celebrating? If it's not New Year's...
Almost every other holiday in the year has some astronomical basis. The Chinese New Year, the Jewish New Year, Ramadan, Easter, Lent...
Toyota-thon. All of it.
There's something go. You know, Saturnalia. Christmas.
What is Saturnalia?
Saturnalia. It's back in the winter.
Yeah.
Where you want to the sun is getting lower and lower in the sky each day. Yeah. And you worry that maybe it'll never come back.
Oh.
And so then
is Saturn getting higher in the sky?
Well, no, but Saturn is the god that you pray to and celebrate. And it's Saturnalia is where everything flips. So the master serves the slave gives commands. Oh, okay. It's an interesting Roman tradition that is long gone.
All right.
But I'm just saying it's in that time of the year where the sun is basically reborn. So it's solstice celebrations. And Christmas was put there to be a good place to sort of bring in all the pagan worshipers who were already celebrating that time of year.
And it worked.
Yeah, it worked.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We won. Now, okay, so 2018, what's got you excited for 2018? We won. What are you talking about? We won. What's got you excited for 2018?
Not only won, wait, just to be clear.
Okay.
You not only won there.
Yeah.
You won the calendar race, too.
Huh?
The world's calendar is the Gregorian calendar after Pope Gregory. Put that into place in 1582. Because the previous Julian calendar was messing up in the year.
It was off by like
10 days.
Okay.
It was off by 10 days.
Yeah.
And the Pope said, we got to fix this.
So the Pope fixed it.
Pope! Well, Pope, his Jesuit scientists.
Okay.
The Jesuit priests were like the academic order of the Catholic. You're Catholic. You should be teaching this, okay?
I'm aware of my religion.
Okay. So there's a Vatican observatory to this day that at the time, before telescopes were invented, these Jesuit priests were put into the service of figuring out why the calendar was shifting in the year.
Well, am I correct in saying that it was a Catholic priest who first proposed the idea of the Big Bang?
Yes, Georges Lemaître.
Wow.
Yes, the Big Bang itself, using Einstein's equations. Einstein could have done it, but Einstein did enough.
Yeah, he was busy.
He did enough.
Yes.
Laid down the equations. Other people calculated with his equations, and he deduces that the history of the universe must have started with a bang.
Wow. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So going to 2018.
So Catholics have been in there in multiple places.
You don't have to tell me.
Okay.
I'm Team RC. Now.
Team Roman Catholic. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Now. Here. Walking footnote, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
I didn't think you brought people with you on that comment. So I'm just helping it out.
You were with me. Okay.
No, anyway, that's not how you ask it. Who was not with him? See? Yeah. There you go.
I feel betrayed. All right. So 2018. Let me get to the second question of the interview. In 2018, what mystery are you most interested in science cracking? Or what do you think we are likely to learn this year that we're close to figuring out?
In my field, the good thing about it is generally we make discoveries when a mission is launched. And
okay, sent. Sure.
So we know when to begin to expect discoveries.
What's the big mission that's reaching its
fruition? Well, no, the mission's in progress now to try to understand dark matter and dark energy more than we currently do. We know it's there, but it's a complete mystery. We don't understand the origin of 85% of all the gravity of the universe. It's not black holes, comets, stars, planets. It's none of the above.
So the math says there should be more there, but we can't see it.
Right. So it's actually missing gravity rather than missing mass. It's gravity with no known source.
Which is what I said.
I like to think of it as dark gravity.
It's dark gravity.
It's really dark gravity.
Wow.
That's really what it is. Then there's some mysterious pressure in the vacuum of space.
What do you mean?
Which we call dark energy, but we should just call those Fred and Wilma. I joke about this because we don't know what they are.
So don't give it
a name that makes you think we know what it is because we don't actually know what it is. But it's there. We measure it. A mysterious pressure in the vacuum of space that is forcing the universe to accelerate in its expansion. And I've written about this because I lose sleep over this fact. Can I share this? I don't want to be blamed.
I doubt I could stop you.
I don't want to be blamed if you cannot get to sleep tonight.
No, I'll be okay.
Okay. All right. So, this dark energy in the future will render the universe so large, having accelerated so significantly that all the galaxies of the night sky will have accelerated beyond our horizon.
What?
And all the galaxies are the source of our knowledge of cosmology, of the Big Bang. Everything we know about the history of the universe comes to us from these galaxies. If they accelerate beyond our horizon, the next generation of cosmic explorers will only have the stars of the Milky Way to think about. And so There would have been an entire chapter of the universe ripped from their view. And they will be trying to contemplate an understanding of the universe without a significant part of what its past was. And so I lose sleep wondering, today, was there some previous chapter ripped from the universe itself? And here we are. And here we are, you know, touching the elephant, not knowing that, in fact, there's an elephant standing there. Or maybe there's the shadow of the elephant and the elephant has been moved. We don't know what we don't know. And this leaves me awake at night. I lose sleep over that.
I'm not going to get a wink. That's crazy.
This is Radio Justice. The name of this program is Emanations. My name is Bernard White. One of the important and respected activist organizations on the East Coast is the People's Organization for Progress, also known as POP. The chair of this organization for over 30 years is Larry Hamm. Larry is a dynamic spokesperson with a good sense of history. Periodically, we've had lengthy conversations on a variety of topics. Today, we're going to share one of those conversations with you.